Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello and welcome to Contemplations. I am joined by Thomas.
Hello.
And I am Josh. And we are going to be talking about the philosophy of objectivism, which is heavily associated with its founder, Ayn Rand. So we're going to be talking a bit about who she is before actually talking about the philosophy itself, because I think that her background very much shapes her perspective on the world. Hmm. But before I get into that, I thought I'd give you a little tidbit of the philosophy before talking about her life itself. And this is just a quote from Ayn Rand herself in the appendix to Atlas Shrugged, which is one of her novels, which we'll talk about in a second. And it is, "My philosophy, in essence, is the concept of a man as a heroic being, with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life, with productive achievement as his noblest activity, and reason as his only absolute."
Mm.
So there we go. So that gives you a bit of a taste of what the philosophy is all about. But first of all, I think it's very important to talk about who Ayn Rand actually was. So she was born in Russia in 1905, in St. Petersburg in Russia. Her birth name was Alyssa Zinovyevna.
That sounds close enough.
That's close enough for me. I mean, she doesn't go by that anymore, so it's fine. Well, she's dead, but she never went by that. Rosenbaum, she was the eldest of three daughters born into a bourgeois Jewish family. However, she later rejected her religious background entirely, along with all religions in general. Rand claimed that she found school unchallenging and began writing screenplays at the age of 8 and novels at the age of 10.
Impressive.
That sounds impressive, although that sounds like one of those things like, yes, I was writing novels by the time I could read and write.
Yeah, I did make attempts at that age, but they wouldn't qualify as actual screenplays.
I would imagine that they're not quite up to scratch, but there we go. She supported, this is going on a little bit in time, but she supported the provisional government overthrowing the Tsar in 1917. Obviously, this is when she was only, 12 years old? Mm. So, I mean, make of that what you will.
Yeah.
The political opinions of a 12-year-old, I don't think we can judge anyone there. But after the November Revolution, where the Bolsheviks took over, they confiscated her father's business and they fled to the Crimea, which I believe was then part of Russia, where the White faction, which was made up of kind of the Democrats and the autocrats, or the liberals, and the Tsarists, if you will.
Yeah.
So the White faction, which was a coalition of them, who eventually lost, by the way, controlled the Crimea, and they stayed there for a while. However, the Whites eventually lost the Civil War. Although this isn't why they left, I don't think. But they returned to St. Petersburg, which was then named Petrograd in 1921, where they nearly starved in poor conditions. So it was quite a fall to come from living in a family where your father owned a business to being in terrible conditions, nearly starving.
Yeah, subjects of famine.
Mm-hmm. But then, I mean, who wasn't in the Soviet Union at that time?
Sadly.
At the age of 16, she managed to enroll in a university, which recently became open to women at the time, where she majored in history. She came across the philosophical works of Aristotle, Plato, and Nietzsche. However, before graduating, she was purged from the university shortly before actually graduating, which happened to many other students as well. They didn't single her out necessarily. I don't think she was a particular dissident then. However, I think what happened was when all of these university students got purged, there were some foreign scientists visiting.
Right.
And they objected to the students being purged, funnily enough. Mm. So eventually the Soviet Union, trying to save face, was just like, oh, no, that's just a mistake. So they reversed their decision and let all the students finish their course.
How very good of them.
I know, how kind, isn't it? Just benevolence of, I suppose, at that time, Lenin.
Yes, before things got, escalated to get significantly worse after that.
Mm-hmm. So it was after this happened, I imagine, nearly being purged is a pretty significant point in your life. She decided upon adopting the surname Rand, which is graphically similar to part of her birth name, without any vowels in it in Cyrillic, and she adopted the name Iron. So you can understand why you would want to change your name when the authorities are after you, particularly if you're writing.
Yes, it'd make you an easy target, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm. So eventually in 1925, she got a visa to visit relatives in America, and upon visiting New York in 1926, when she actually got round to using the visa, she was so impressed by the Manhattan skyline that she cried tears of splendor.
Quite a fan at the sight of deco architecture then.
Well, I imagine in 1926, it probably would have been quite amazing, especially to someone from Russia, where you simply didn't have that level of wealth, did you?
No, not at all.
So I can understand. Apparently, she liked it so much, she basically stayed there. In 1929, she married an American actor named Frank O'Connor and finally became an American resident. So basically, when she travelled out there, she realised she wanted to live there. Eventually met someone and got married to get a visa, although I'm sure there are other reasons as well. So in the 1940s, she began to become more involved in politics and working full-time as a volunteer for the Republican presidential candidate, Wendell Willkie, who at the time was actually the only one who wanted to intervene in World War II.
That's interesting.
And she became involved in the Anti-Communist Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals and wrote articles on the group's behalf. And she also joined the Anti-Communist American Writers Association. So you can see there's a clear opinion here that communism bad.
Yeah, and, which, and it's no wonder she had such a vehement hatred for it, given that, well...
What it did to her,
what it did to her. She had to change her entire identity to escape it, effectively. Mm-hmm.
I imagine it probably would have been insufferable with all the apologists in the kind of writing sphere as well. So I don't blame her for going into it.
No.
Because, of course, at this time, people had an idea about what was going on. But, for example, the New York Times was reporting that people were hungry but not quite starving when millions of people were dying. But, you know.
Helpful article.
Yes. But moving on to her main key works, and there's two works that are of particular note. The first of which of note is her 1943 novel The Fountainhead, which was her first major success. And to just to demonstrate how successful it was, although it was released in 1943, by 1949 it was being turned into a film, which surprisingly enough followed the novel with few alterations. However, she described disliking the film from beginning to end. Both the acting and the editing, apparently.
Her husband didn't act in it, did he?
I don't think so. She's a big fan of merit, so I imagine he wasn't.
No, that would be consistent with her with her worldview, I suppose.
So the novel itself, I'm not going to go into this one into much detail because it's also one that I believe people it's on the syllabus in schools, at least in the United States, and sometimes in the UK, although I've actually never read the books themselves. I've had to look at the philosophy secondhand, but that's worth bearing in mind, I suppose, when I'm talking about it. However, the books are massive, and I'd simply don't have the time.
Literally thousands of pages, and to be honest, most people probably never get the time to read the whole
thing. I'll get around to it eventually, but I've heard and I've picked up enough over the years from people, and I've also actually looked at the philosophy in great detail, so I feel like I understand it. But nevertheless, The Fountainhead focuses on a young architect named Howard Roark and his struggle against what Rand describes as second-handers, those who live vicariously through others or place others above themselves, which, you know, sounds like an interesting perspective on things. And I certainly don't like people who are like that. And I like the fact that she's trying to combat this thing, which is seen as quite positive in many Western societies. Living through others or placing others above yourself. It's seen as altruistic and noble. However, as we've seen in modern politics, it's not always that way. People have these aspirations. They believe they're doing good. However, they're doing immense evil to both themselves, society, and the people they pose to be caring about.
Even though they're persuaded that they are themselves pursuing the greater good for the benefit of the majority.
Exactly. So, following the success of her previous novel, she went on to write Atlas Shrugged, which is the one which is probably most associated with demonstrating objectivism in action, or should I say, using literary devices to argue philosophical points, more or less. Mm-hmm. And this is the one that was probably the most popular, as we shall see in a second, but this is largely considered her best novel, unsurprisingly, by the fact it's quite popular. And she's clearly written this novel with her philosophy in mind. It seems to me, from the extracts that I've read and from what I've read about people reviewing it, mm-hmm. That she's had this philosophy kind of very much consciously in mind as she's been writing the story, and she's wrote it around her philosophy in a way.
So she kind of developed the philosophy as she wrote the novel.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of, it reminds me a little bit of Albert Camus and his kind of absurdist existentialism, mm-hmm. because he wasn't strictly a philosopher, was he? He was more of a writer, a novelist.
Yeah.
However, there is philosophy demonstrated in his writings, mm-hmm. That's valuable and interesting, and sometimes using literature to demonstrate your philosophy is actually quite a good way of getting people to understand it, because it makes the abstract more concrete.
It does. Well, you could argue it's actually a better way if you can achieve it, but you have to be a good enough writer to be able to do it. And that's, mm-hmm. but that's one problem that many philosophers have, that as in they have great ideas, but an inability to articulate them in a way that's comprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
Literature is a magnificent tool for that, and quite clearly she had a talent for it to a degree.
Yeah, I mean, we'll be looking at some of her extracts from Atlas Shrugged in a second, and I think it's nice language at the very least, and quite impressive considering it's a second language as well.
Mm.
So Rand described the main theme running through the novel as the role of the mind in man's existence, and as a colliery, the demonstration of a new moral philosophy, the morality of rational self-interest.
Rational self-interest.
Yes.
Hmm.
But it's quite often posed, and this is a bit of a, I don't want to call it a faux pas, but it's a bit of a stereotype, I suppose, to talk about objectivism and just say, oh, that's just selfishness. That's just a philosophy that justifies selfishness. But it's not being selfish, because Rand acknowledges that if everyone behaved selfishly in the way that we understand it colloquially, as in only just basically pulling other people down to pull themselves up, then it's, you're not going to have a society that functions. But pursuing rational self-interest, that means that you can follow your self-interest, but it's also in your self-interest to say, to pull up the people who you, obviously your family, your friends, those who you do business with maybe,
mm-hmm.
because if everyone is doing well, then it's a multiplying effect on society.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that you even get Jordan Peterson talking about. People who improve themselves are the best for the people around them. So
yes.
This is almost allegorical to this kind of philosophy where this self-reflection, self-improvement, this is very much egoistic, isn't it? It's focused on the self, and yet it has a benefit to people around them.
Yeah, there is like a transformative interdependence, you could say, as in an acknowledgement that we're all entering the arena out of self-interest, but we nonetheless understand that the meeting of our own needs depends on us actually being a benefit to the people around us, and that in turn increases the value that other people see in us, and you actually get some positive loop going.
If you take the example of, say, it might be... say, to take a really extreme example, you could say, okay, well, it's this murderer wants to selfishly kill people.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be reasonable to say that's in his self-interest, because it's going to not only harm society, harm the things in which he depends on, it's also going to put himself in trouble, but he might selfishly have this desire. It doesn't mean just pursuing what you want to do. It means pursuing what is truly your self-interest, and you might not be able to perceive your self-interest. You may have a misguided understanding of it,
yes.
But it doesn't mean that it exists outside of yourself.
Dare I say, that would qualify as a false consciousness in Ayn Rand's philosophy.
To
think that making an enterprise out of murder is in your own self-interest and the interest of others.
Yeah, and we'll see later on when we apply her philosophy to politics that she wasn't against, punishing people for committing crimes. Mm. It wasn't against that sort of thing. Law and order, you know, is something that wasn't really up for debate then, to be honest. So to move on, to talk a little bit about the content of the novel itself, like many Russian novelists, she used long speeches to communicate her philosophy, which is kind of in the vein of Dostoevsky, who she recognised as a great psychologist and writer.
Oh, definitely.
I can't say I've actually read any of his work, but
I've only read Crime and Punishment. It's it's brilliant. I'd really recommend it.
Mm-hmm. I have a few of his books, and I've just got this massive pile of stuff I need to get through at the minute. Making my way through Basic Economics by Thomas Sowell at the minute, and that's a massive tome. So like
first world problems.
I know. Just too many books. I need to make less of them so I can catch up.
Like, thanks, capitalism.
So the novel itself, Atlas Shrugged, is based on a dystopian United States in which the most creative industrialists, scientists and artists respond to a welfare state government by going on strike and retreating to a hidden valley where they build an independent free economy. Mm. Basically, the idea is that the welfare state had got so massive that it was just inescapable, and that it was just too much for the people who are actually being productive in society to deal with. There wasn't enough of an incentive for them to carry on, and so they just simply leave.
Sounds strangely familiar.
It does, yeah. This is part of the reason why I thought it'd be interesting to talk about it, other than the fact that I've been asked to cover this quite a few times. So the novel follows the leader of the strike, John Galt, who describes the move as stopping the motor of the world by removing those who contribute most to the nation's wealth and achievements. And it's interesting here that she picks out industrialists, scientists and artists in particular.
Yeah.
So not politicians, for a start. Mm. She doesn't even necessarily specify philosophers, which is interesting.
Yes, very.
Not even academics, just artists, industrialists, and scientists.
I'm most surprised by the inclusion of artists.
Mm-hmm. But she didn't deny that. We'll get onto aesthetics, but she didn't deny that there was value in art. She saw it as, she actually has a very similar view of art that I do. And I think it's actually one of the areas where objectivism is most palatable to the average person.
Perhaps misrepresented on this subject then.
Yeah, it's not akin to, say, communist or Soviet ideology where it fetishizes industry above all else.
Yeah.
She recognizes that for a human being to become well-rounded, I suppose, you need knowledge of the world like facts, but you also need reasons to acquire it through the arts. You need motivation.
Sources of inspiration. And
exactly.
And you can't get that from a material understanding of the world strictly.
And in the novel, eventually when these people set up their own parallel society away from the United States, the America that they left eventually collapses, and all the productive people go back, take it over, they live happily ever after.
No. Lovely.
I'm sure it's more complicated than that, and as I've said, I haven't read it, but that's just the brief summary of roughly what happens. Sorry if I've spoilt it for you, but I think everyone knows roughly the plot of it. It's like the Bible, isn't it? Which is a fitting comparison in a second. Don't worry, I'm not being blasphemous here. This is, but I'll get on to that. So I'm going to read some quotes now, and we're going to have a look at the underlying philosophy and just what we think of the writing, I suppose. So the first one is, if you saw Atlas, the giant who holds the world on his shoulders, if you saw that he stood, blood running down his chest, his knees buckling, his arms trembling, but still trying to hold the world aloft with his last of his strength, and the greater his effort, the heavier the world bore down upon his shoulders, what would you tell him? And the person responds, I don't know. What could he do? What would you tell him? And the other person responds, to shrug. So, of course, this is where the novel gets its name.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's trying to suggest that the mind is the one that does the productive work, and you have a heavy burden in existence, and you simply have to shrug off, if you will, that burden and get on with what the task you have to do.
Yes.
Which is very Petersonian, isn't it?
It is.
And I think it's also a very valuable moral lesson that I think many people could benefit from. And I think the resurgence of that being one of Peterson's main kind of mimetic phrases, if you will, is no coincidence. And I think that the fact that people haven't recognised this value in objectivism is something that it kind of gives that a little bit of a boost, if you will.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.